PRI, Public Radio International.
Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston Cyr.
An hymn to the evening. Soon, as the sun forsook the eastern main, the pealing thunder shook the heavenly plain. Majestic grandeur from the zephyr's wing exhales the incense of the blooming spring. Soft pearls the stream, the birds renew their notes, and through the air their mingled music floats. Through all the heavens, what beauteous dyes are spread, but the west glories in the deepest red. So may our breasts with every virtue glow, the living temples of our God below. Filled with the praise of Him who gives the light and draws the sable curtains of the night, let placid slumber soothe each weary mind, at morn to wake more heavenly, more refined. So shall the labors of the day begin more pure, more guarded from the snares of sin. Night's laden scepter seals my drowsy eyes, then cease my song till fair aurora rise.
I must confess to taking real delight in those works of literature that take the reader vividly back into the reality of a bygone age. And this pleasure is even more enhanced when the authors who speak through those pages bear authentic witness to manners, customs, and events that influenced and reflected the great issues of their day. Imagine, then, when the authors' voices that now echo through the centuries are those that were largely unheard in their own day and, sadly, neglected ever since. This is the precise and poignant case of the eloquent black authors of the 18th century. Cruelly pitted against bondage and bigotry, they wrote with a passion and grace that deserves to be heard in our day. My guest is Vincent Caretta, editor of Unchained Voices, published by the University Press of Kentucky. Vincent, welcome back to Dialogue.
Thank you. I'm glad to be back.
I'm glad to have you back again, Vincent, and thanks for this book, Unchained Voices. Let me start right off by saying how much I've enjoyed reading it. And I think in the course of this conversation, others are going to get an even better sense of that. To start right where you start, this is an anthology of black authors who wrote in the 18th century and who were essentially Afro-Britons, at least for the most part. And I'm very intrigued by that. And they were that by style and also by their allegiance to Britain, something else that I'd like to probe with you. But before turning to that, since most of us in America are familiar with 19th century slave narratives, what's the essential difference between the 18th century writing in this book and the kinds of things such as Frederick Douglass's narratives we're used to?
Well, let me start by just giving kind of overview of what the 19th century slave narrative usually means. It usually means someone who was born a slave and who grew up on a plantation. We think of the cotton plantation, we think of the North American model. And that person usually lives out their whole life in slavery.
Right.
In the 18th century, it's a much more varied picture. Most, at least half of the writers in this book, there are 16 writers represented in the book, and half of them were born in Africa. So they have a memory of having been free. They have not been acculturated into slavery. Half of them, more than half of them, become free by the time they're writing their text or narrating their text to someone else. So freedom is a strong possibility. It's not simply reserved for the afterlife. Mm-hmm. And we have a range of writers here who are, some of them were never slaves, some of them owned slaves themselves, though they were black. So we don't have the kind of homogeneous figure that we think of in the 19th century.
Right. Another aspect of this that's fascinating to me in this, the pre-1800 writings we're discussing that are the subject of Unchained Voices, is the importance of Britain to all of this. The the allegiance, almost the choice of Britain as, if not quite the promised land, at least a very desirable place to be, a place where one can be free and where one can essentially be, and this is a very important point, I think, an Afro-Britain. Are those, is that the right kind of perception of these writers?
Well, Britain does become clearly the promised land after 1772, when there's a famous court decision called the Mansfield decision, in which Chief Justice Mansfield ruled that a slave brought from the colonies to England, if the slave refused to go back to the colonies, could not legally be forced to do so. So, in effect, it's a kind of emancipation proclamation. Commentators at the time and commentators now are still arguing over whether it abolished slavery. But as soon as slaves realized that they could run off once they're in England, and there's lots of evidence that they were protected by what we would call the working classes. And we have evidence, for example, Virginia newspapers of advertisements for runaway slaves. There was a slave named Bacchus, for example, in 1774, who runs away, and his master says that he's sure he's fleeing to England because of the Somerset decision. And that's only one of the ads that we have. So there are a number of pieces of evidence for that. England is a promised land. In England, even if you're a slave, you're not a plantation slave. You're not working on a gang of slaves. You're a domestic slave. In America, being a domestic slave was much preferable. Right. Phyllis Wheatley is a good example, who talks about almost having been a part of the family. So to get to England means that you have the opportunity to define yourself as Afro-British. I'm saying Afro-British as opposed to simply slave. Mm-hmm. And we have a number of these writers who address that issue.
I'm very glad you introduced Phyllis Wheatley at this point, because we're going to turn directly to her and several others and sort of explore some of the things they wrote. Before we do that, though, Van, let me take a moment to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest is Vincent Coretta, editor of Unchained Voices, published by the University Press of Kentucky. One further question has occurred to me before we turn to Phyllis Wheatley and the authors, Vincent. By, let's say, roughly 1789, 1790, have the writers represented in Unchained Voices and their production, their writings, have they amounted to what we might call something of a tradition within British literature? Is there that much of a body of work here that's come to be regarded as, quote, Afro-British literature at that time?
Well, let me, if I can, make a distinction between a tradition and a canon. A tradition is when one author writes and is aware of preceding authors.
Right.
A canon is constructed afterwards by critics. Mm-hmm. Would say, I'm in part trying to construct a canon in Unchained Voices by recovering these black voices. But in the process of doing so, I also discovered that there is a tradition that people weren't aware of. For example, Britton Hammond, the first author here, is now part of the canon of Afro-British writers, or writers of African descent, let's say. But he's not part of a tradition, because as far as we can tell, no one else, no later black writers, was aware of his writing, which is probably because he was published only in Boston. So it was a provincial publication. On the other hand, someone like Ignatius Sancho is known, we know he's known to the other writers because they invoke him, they refer to him, they cite him. Quabna Adaba Kuguano, the most radical of all of these writers by far.
Also known as James Stewart, right?
Right, John Stewart.
John Stewart.
Writes, he refers to John Morant in his text and to Ukasaw Graniasaw in his text, which is a way of saying, I am part of a tradition. You know, we are here. Mm-hmm. I'm not alone. Equiano does this a great deal, in part through his subscription list. He has several blacks, including Kuguano. He lists William's son of Ignatius Sancho, even though William's only 13 at the time. It's clearly Equiano's way of getting Sancho in that subscription list and consciously constructing a tradition.
That's a very, very helpful definition. So we can say then that amongst at least a significant number of them, there was an awareness of the others writing,
Yes.
and there was a sense of tradition. Turning now to the writers themselves, and let's start with Phyllis Wheatley, because she is probably the best-known name among them in our country. I was very impressed by her poetry in terms of the style and quality of it, and while I'm no expert on the writings of the period, it seemed to me she wrote very much in the classical idiom of the poetry of her time. I was also impressed by something else, Vincent, because you mentioned her going to England, but her return to America, her sense of herself as, quote, an American poet in her poetry is really stunning when you think of her condition. Is that a correct perception?
Well, it depends on at what point you read her poetry. She does have a poem that she published, that she wrote early in praise of King George III when he signed the repeal of the Stamp Act. Then, as I say, she bets on America. She goes back to America, bets on America. She never got her second volume published in America. She almost certainly would have if she had stayed in Britain. And she has a poem to George Washington. She has a number of what we would call patriotic poems like that after 1775, let's say. So she, of course, died young, around 30. And her volume of poems, which is the basis of what we know of her as a poet, were written when she was a teenager. She went over to England when she was about 20. So we're judging a great deal
On a very
on
brief period.
adolescent poetry. And as you say, she's very neoclassical in a number of those poems, which is not unusual because that's how you ch and she's self-taught. She's like Equiano. She's an autodidact. And so it's very common in the 18th century to train yourself by imitating models.
Well, you know, it's striking when you read her poems. I'm just having read through them myself. It almost stands, "Great Countess, we Americans revere thy name and thus condole thy grief sincere." We Americans. There are several repetitions of that in here. And of course, the poem to His Excellency General Washington that she wrote in sort of in praise of him, and actually, I think, sent to him. So, yeah, it is, in fact, a brief period on which to make a judgment. And I think you make some very, very important distinctions. But it does stand out, this kind of American identity that she seems to give
Well,
such emphasis to.
as I said earlier, I think it's her hope that this freedom for America will include her. And she is writing from in Boston, and she was manumitted, freed, very soon after going back to Boston with her master from England. So she has reason to hope. In 1783, Massachusetts removed slavery, I mean, outlawed slavery, so that, and she dies the next year, but there was a movement towards outlawing slavery in Massachusetts. It was, palpable. Everyone could see where it was going. And so it's not strange to me that she would place her bet there.
So to speak. Turning now to my favorite from the book, a very colorful gentleman, I must say, almost Falstaffian, I think, in his dimensions, at least one gets that impression, Mr. Ignatius Sancho. He was, and I mean, the qualities of this man are astounding. Even the more so when you think that he is an Afro-Briton of his age, but he was a correspondent of Laurence Sterne, who wrote Tristram Shandy. He himself wrote an amazing variety of topics. Just reading through his letters that are in Unchained Voices, I mean, maritime policy, animal rights, theater, and of course, abolition, just a handful of the things he wrote. And generally with great humor and wit, or at least so it occurred to me. So I guess one first question about him, Vincent, is at what level did he operate in the London society of his time? Because on the face of it, it seems that he had some influence.
I'm not surprised that he's your favorite. I would have guessed that as you being a raconteur as is he, and someone who's known for his though it's written for his voice. He had a very interesting place in London society. He is the only documented black who had the vote. That doesn't mean that he's the only one who had the vote. In England, people weren't normally identified by race as they were in America. So he voted, I found his record for having voted for Member of Parliament in 1774 and 1780. So he's a citizen. He's not simply a subject. He's one of a very small percentage of people living in Britain who could vote. I mean, most white men couldn't vote. So I think we need to keep that in mind. He's very literate. Yes, he does correspond with Sterne. He initiated the correspondence. He wrote to Sterne to thank him for some sentimental passages that Sterne wrote about slavery and said, write more, do more. Sterne wrote back to him. Eventually, Sterne was trying to get Sancho's help in selling Sterne's books. He's saying, write to your former patron, bring them copies, sign them up. He's well respected. He was the butler, which is a very high status position, as a servant position. So it's the top of the hierarchy among the servants, domestic servants, for the Duke of Montague, who had a position at the Castle of Windsor. So Sancho probably at least saw the monarch George III. He writes with a great deal of familiarity about members of the royal family. He dedicates books to the royal family, some of which still exist, so that we know that he fairly easily moved among all these circles, and yet he never lost touch with where he came from.
Exactly, yeah.
He writes to and helps former slaves. We don't sense any kind of condescension in his writing to them. There's certainly none of the, I've got to deny that past because now I've got this new identity. He has a remarkable ability of crossing all of these sort of social lines and
Indeed,
economic lines.
indeed. I mean, he's, to use a phrase, I suppose, that dates from the time, a man of parts in every sense. And to pick up on your points, Vincent, because he does not turn his back on his brethren or his origins, and because he, like so many others in this book, do give substantial attention to the growing cause of abolition as it becomes a debate in England. What judgment do you make on the weight of what they did, in a literary sense, on abolition? I mean, what effect did their joined voices, if you will, have as that question was being discussed and debated?
Well, some had much more than others. Sancho, Wheatley, and Francis Williams tend to get quoted often in the abolitionist debates because, and again, we're talking about the abolition of the slave trade primarily, because they are used as representatives of what blacks are capable of. Apologists for slavery who are saying, well, blacks are naturally are designed to be enslaved because they're brutish, they're not civilized, they can't be civilized. Well, the quickest answer to that is say, well, what about someone like Ignatius Sancho, who's written the book? What about Phyllis Wheatley, who writes poetry? A good example of the problems that Sancho or Wheatley pose to an apologist for slavery like Thomas Jefferson is Thomas Jefferson's comments on them in Notes on Virginia. And Jefferson says of Wheatley, religion made a Phyllis Wheatley, but religion couldn't make a poet, and he just dismisses her. But then he has to deal with Sancho, and he has a much longer passage on Sancho, and he says if we judge him as a letter writer, we have to put him at the top of his race. But if we judge him against all other letter writers, we put him on the bottom of the list, which is negative, yet he's still on the list. Jefferson can't dismiss him. Jefferson makes a dismissive move. He says, well, we don't know. You know, we can't say with certainty whether he authored everything he said, but Jefferson can't deny it. So he's left with Sancho as still a literate figure. And this is in the context of Jefferson's dealing with the racial distinctions among humans.
You know, to seize on the point you're making right now, Vincent, there's another reference here that I think is very important to Thomas Jefferson. That's when we discuss Benjamin Banneker, who's in this book. Benjamin Banneker, like practically everyone else in here, self-taught, and he's of course an astronomer, and he's someone who is you know, gained an enormous amount of scientific knowledge in a very rough-hewn way, and done it, by all accounts, quite brilliantly. Composed an almanac, which he sends to Jefferson, who's then Secretary of State, I think, and that must have created some additional dilemmas for Mr. Jefferson in terms of categorizing this this product.
Right. Jefferson sends it on to a Frenchman to show him what American blacks are capable of, though the tone of Jefferson's letter to the Frenchman suggests that he's sees this as unusual, as a kind of sport, not really typical. Banneker is a freeman. He was born free in Maryland, and he rather cleverly, when he writes to Jefferson, quotes back the Declaration of Independence at him, and in effect says, you know, I'm here. Isn't it in time to include me and the we? And so it's not simply a sending him the almanac and you know, kind of begging for his patronage. It's virtually a demand for what's due. You know, it's a bill come due kind of approach.
You mentioned earlier that we must be very careful about not overestimating the degree of agency or range of options that people of African descent in that period had, whether they were slaved or enslaved or free. Nevertheless, Finn, I hope you'd agree that this book does reflect a very wide variety of persons and fates. And what I have in mind here are people like Britton Hammond, whose tale here reads like a kind of a typical picaresque Avenger. I mean, shipwrecked, marooned, and every other kind of swashbuckling fate that can befall you. There's a man named Johnson Green who recounts almost you could sing it like a kind of a folk song, a life of thievery and debauchery that ends up with him facing the gallows on the 17th of August, 1786. I mean, what I'm getting at is that there's a pretty wide range of stories in Unchained Voices.
Right. There is not the 19th century, to go back to an earlier question you asked. In the 19th century is a kind of formulaic slave narrative. In the 18th century, there isn't. Slaves are writing all sorts of things. And sometimes we don't know if they're slaves or not, like Britton Hammond.
Right.
In fact, if we weren't told in the title that he was a Negro, we wouldn't know from the internally. And it's still disputed whether he was free or not.
Well, Vincent, this book is full of many eloquent voices, and it's impossible to do justice to all of them in the space of the brief conversation we have. But a couple of questions occur to me as we come to the conclusion of it. One is, you mentioned at the outset and a very helpful distinction between the kinds of voices and writing that are included in this collection of 18th century pieces and the sort of 19th century slave narratives that are particularly known to Americans. Frederick Douglass immediately comes to mind. In this collection of Unchained Voices, are there any you would cite as precursors of the kind of 19th century slave narrative that we're used to? Any that began to sort of bridge that gap or cross that chasm or sort of resemble that style?
Well, the one that people think of is usually Equiano's The Interesting Narrative, because it does have certain similarities. I tend to be reluctant to push the similarities, because then people, and there have been people who've taken this approach, they tend to look for intimations of Frederick Douglass in the earlier works and downplay those things in the earlier works that are more original and that make them distinctive in themselves.
Right.
A number of the later slave narratives in the 18th century, for example, Boston Kings is a kind of miniature version of the 19th century slave narrative.
Right.
Except Boston King is another figure who chooses the British and leaves the Americans behind. In fact, he ends up in Sierra Leone in Africa. So it's I'm in some ways at least as interested in the dissimilarities
mm-hmm.
as in the similarities.
And then this question, Vincent, because I think it's the obvious one to conclude this conversation on as a professor of literature, because ultimately it's a question of, as with any body of literature, what its place is in terms of the period and in terms of our understanding, both in literary and historical sense, the contribution it made. So how would you characterize, as a body, the authors that are represented here in Unchained Voices?
Well, again, there is a range of quality. Equiano, I think, can wrestle with anyone, virtually. Sancho has, last year I published an edition of his letters, so they're now widely available through Penguin. And I think his stock is going to go up as people have the opportunity to see what he can do, as you described, with language, with the tone of voice, with playing with audience. So we have a number of the writers who are of high quality, independent of their being black. In other words, it's not a matter of these are the best black writers we have. I've taught Equiano in 18th century literature courses for years as autobiography. He happens to be black. But if you're going to ask, well, what are the alternative autobiographies? People think of Benjamin Franklin, who some people have called Equiano the black Benjamin Franklin. I like to point out that since Franklin's autobiography was published after Equiano's, perhaps we should call Franklin the black, the white Equiano, rather.
That's a wonderful answer. Well, Vincent, I've very much enjoyed this, and let me conclude by recommending to everyone listening, literally, that Unchained Voices is a book well worth reading for the quality of writing in it and for the window, if you will, on a century, a period, and a group of people that deserve to be remembered and read again. So thank you for this book.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Vincent Caretta, professor of literature at the University of Maryland. I'm George Liston CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Our associate producer is Karen Reed. Our technical director is John Tyler, and our production assistants are Cheris Donnelly and Kristen Hunter. The poetry reading was by Lynn Jones. Dialogue is presented by PRI, Public Radio International, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in association with Smithsonian Productions. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For cassettes or more information on Dialogue, call us at 303-823-8000. Contact us on America Online at Radio Dial. That's RADIODIAL at AOL.com. Visit our internet webpage at www.ics.si.edu.